Welcome to the Nightly Five podcast with Ben O'Shea.
On today's show, a leading internet watchdog has found a disturbing new trend that's exploiting our children. Plus, the murder of a young mum in regional New South Wales has thrown the spotlight on domestic violence in Australia. I'll tell you what Albo has to say about it. Who pays for Bruce Lerman's failed defamation suit against Network 10? Well, that question got more interesting today. I'll tell you why. And concussion in sport is front and centre with a shock early retirement in the NRL. And I'll leave you today with another scandalous revelation from Rebel Wilson. New book. In our top story today, the worst year on record for online child exploitation.
If you wouldn't let your child meet with a stranger, why would you let it happen online?
New data from the Internet Watch Foundation reveals 2023 was its most extreme year on record when it came to reports of online child sexual exploitation and abuse material. Here to tell us more is investigative reporter at The Nightly, Kristen Shorten. Kristen, who are the IWF and how many reports of this kind did they receive last year?
Well, Ben, the Internet Watch Foundation is one of the world's leading organisations fighting online child sexual abuse. They say their goal is to make the internet a safer place for children. So they help child victims of sexual abuse worldwide by identifying and removing the images and videos of their abuse from the internet. So they actually are one of three licensed organisations to hunt down this sexual abuse imagery from the internet. They also run a global hotline offering a safe place for the public to report anonymously, and they develop tools that tech companies can use to make their platform safer. Now, the IWF today released its annual report, its much anticipated annual report, which provided the latest data and analysis about this, you know, terrifying global issue that we're seeing. It revealed, as you mentioned, that 2023 was its most extreme year on record, during which its analysts assessed almost 400,000 reports of online child sexual exploitation and abuse material.
Yeah, that is shocking. And what do we know about the type of reports that this data consisted of?
Well, each year it sees sexual abuse images of children aged 11 to 13, more than any other age group, and overwhelmingly the majority of those victims are girls. But shocking data in this most recent annual report has revealed that opportunistic predators are now manipulating children as young as 3 years old who are using devices, you know, internet-connected devices with a camera inside the family home, and they're manipulating them into disturbing sexual abuse while they're playing online, often, you know, nearby their parents or just in another room. So it found that children aged between 3 and 6 are increasingly being coerced into sexual activities via webcams and camera devices. And during 2023, their analysts discovered almost 2,500 individual self-generated images and videos of children in that age category.
Gosh, it's just like this child exploitation is heinous no matter what, but this is particularly disturbing as a parent. I can't even get my head around, you know, how this is even happening. So what exactly is happening to these kids?
Almost all of the web pages that IWF discovered last year contained self-generated images or videos. So that is where the victim has been coerced, blackmailed, or groomed into performing sexual acts over the webcam for an internet predator in a remote location. So someone who's not in the room with them. So this is called self-generated child sexual abuse imagery, where the perpetrator is remote, and this is occurring in, you know, in our homes, in bedrooms, children's bedrooms, bathrooms, kitchens and dining rooms. So the IWF has really emphasized that the term self-generated doesn't mean the child's instigating the creation of this sexual content themselves, but they are in this age group easily manipulated, and therefore they're an easy target for predators looking to exploit them. And shockingly, about 15% of this self-generated child abuse imagery and videos featuring the 3 to 6 year olds is in the most extreme category, so category A.
And so what is being done to stop it?
Well, as we've talked about, Ben, organisations like the IWF who are hunting down this material and removing it from online, you know, we've got the AFP here, they have a dedicated unit called the ACE, as well as the eSafety Commission of Australia. They're doing everything they can to disrupt and combat this criminal activity and support and rescue the child victims. But politicians and tech giants need to do more to tackle the issue. The IWF's chief executive, Susie Hargrave, said the big tech companies, including social media giants, need to act immediately and not wait to be forced to act through regulation and legislation, because these harms are happening to our kids now and we need an immediate response to this. So the IWF, it works with tech companies to develop, like I mentioned before, the tools and solutions to keep these platforms safe, and they do a lot of that work. But it's becoming, you know, blindingly obvious that companies are still putting profit before child safety and are failing to implement measures to protect children, like age verification and to have the content detected and removed quickly enough. So responsibility for this is also now falling to parents to warn their increasingly younger kids, we're now talking about kids under six, about online dangers and the risks of online sexual exploitation. So, you know, parents are still being urged to talk to their kids regularly, openly, honestly, and frankly about social media use, because the platforms that they presume are safe for their kids to be on unsupervised, it's now obvious that they do pose a risk.
Yeah, I think that's an important message here, that the first line of defence is in the home and its parents, and hopefully that message gets out. Investigative reporter at The Nightly, Kristen Shorten, thanks for sharing this important story.
Thanks for having me.
New details about the brutal murder of a young mother from central New South Wales. Reports Molly Ticehurst's killer was released on bail a fortnight before her death.
Young mum and assistant teacher Molly Ticehurst became at least the 25th woman to be allegedly killed by a man this year when she was found dead on Monday morning. Police allege her former partner, Daniel Billings, who's 29 years old, killed her in the New South Wales central western town of Forbes after being granted conditional release 2 weeks earlier over a series of rape and domestic violence charges. Police say he breached a bail condition that he not visit Forbes after he was accused of sexually assaulting and stalking Miss Ticehurst in January. Questions are being asked about the incident, and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is one of those asking how this terrible crime was allowed to happen. Take a listen to this exchange between the PM and Sunrise host Nat Barr this morning.
Prime Minister, the man was known to authorities. Can you commit to us this morning that with the budget just around the corner, the leaders of this country have a plan to stop women being killed by someone they know? We are doing this story, Prime Minister, every single week.
We need to do more as governments. We need to do more as society. We need to talk about this.
Billings fronted Orange local court today, and court documents showed he was previously accused of raping Miss Ticehurst on three separate occasions, intimidating her on three separate occasions, and willfully damaging her property, including a car window and a pedestal fan. The documents also showed Mr. Billings was charged with aggravated cruelty against a 12-week-old Dachshund puppy. All the charges were related to incidents alleged to have occurred since December last year. Magistrate David Day told the court Mr. Billings was already accused of three serious indictable offences when the alleged murder took place. He said the previous charges were in relation to the same woman found dead on Monday morning. Billings remains in custody and did not apply for bail. The matter has been adjourned until June 20.
Mr. Lerman raped Miss Higgins.
Last week, Justice Michael Lee found on the balance of probabilities Bruce Lerman did rape Brittany Higgins at Parliament House after a night out drinking in 2019. The finding put an end to the defamation case against Network 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson, who had argued a defence of truth. That meant the only thing left was to figure out who picks up the bill, which is expected to run into millions of dollars. We got a fascinating insight into how that process will play out today when the federal court released cost submissions from 10, Lerman and Wilkinson. None of the submissions released today mention a figure, but Network 10 is asking for all costs dating back to August last year. Arguing their case, Network 10 said in the submission that Lerman had engaged in a wicked and calculated legal plan, in part because at the time of commencing the proceeding, Mr. Lerman knew that he had raped Miss Higgins. The network went on to say that, with the benefit of hindsight, his decision to sue Network 10 was a clear abuse of process aimed at concealing the truth that he'd raped Miss Higgins. Network 10 also pointed out that they'd made an offer to Mr. Lerman to settle the claim a month before the trial was due to start. But Lerman told his lawyers to turn it down just 2 hours later. In his response, Mr. Lerman's lawyers admitted that legal precedent, including that in the case of Ben Robert Smith, meant the court could find that he was liable for all the costs. But they argued he should not be ordered to pay them all because a cost order should not be used to punish a particular party. A cost hearing is due to take place before Justice Lee next week.
Into the hands of Finucane, who's going to score a try!
Cronulla co-captain Dale Finucane has announced his immediate retirement today from professional rugby league, ending a 251-game career after he sought medical advice on his history with concussions. Nightly sports editor Ben McClellan joins me in the studio. Ben, what led to Finucane's decision, or as he called it, a no decision?
Yeah, well, it's come as a bit of a shock. I mean, Finucane, I know we throw this term around pretty freely, but he's definitely one of the hard men of the NRL. He had been out with injury and was training with the squad ahead of their big win over North Queensland last week. But then there's been this snap press conference call today where he's revealed that, based on medical advice, he's calling it quits. We knew he was going to retire at the end of the season. That had been flagged by Dale already. But the fact that he's had to pull up stumps much more quickly is obviously a much bigger development in the story. So, not unsurprising given the blows. He's taken over his 250-game career, but still with any of these sort of stalwart-type players retiring like this, it comes as a shock, and it's coming on the same day as Wally Lewis, the king of rugby league, has given quite an impassioned speech at the National Press Club, where he's implored for nearly $20 million in funding to help CTE awareness research. He was joined by another recently retired sports player, Nathan Murphy from the AFL, who was in the crowd. So, yeah, I guess it makes you think about how many of these players, in the decades gone by have continued to play or seen out their last season when they probably should have been medically retired, like Dale has today.
Yeah, well, it's actually amazing that Finucane has lasted as long as he has. Yep. And probably only because it's only more recently that yep. we've started to take CTE and these types of brain injuries more seriously. So he was a lock forward. So he definitely copped a lot of punishment and knocks to the head. And he said today that, his wife was concerned and he was concerned because the number of times that he had concussions that meant that he couldn't return to the playing field was in the double digits for his career. And they were becoming more frequent over his career with the Sharks and the Doggies and the Storm and games for New South Wales. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing for me, listening to Wally Lewis at the National Press Club today, talking about CTE, we know it's been an issue in American football closer to home. We've had Shane Tuck and Polly Farmer in the AFL and Heather Anderson in the AFLW be diagnosed with CTE after they've died. In rugby league, Corey Parker believes he suffers from chronic traumatic encephalopathy as well. But I listened to Finucane today and, he went to see his neurologist and the neurologist said, well, mate, based on how many times you've had concussions, you should just pull a pin immediately.
Mm.
If you were a neurologist, right, and your concern was the human brain, the health of the human brain, it must be tempting to tell every professional rugby league player and AFL player, if you care about your brain, you probably should give it up.
Sort of shouldn't play a contact sport. I guess that's a pretty obvious one, but I think the players, when they're at the level of seeing a neurologist, it's when it's much more serious. Yeah. I don't think too many teams have neurologists on staff.
They don't want them in the building.
There is the clubs are taking this more seriously, basically because they have to. The doctors and medical staff at the clubs, I guess, when in years gone by, may have been looking to see how they can, pass players to play.
Yeah, get around the concussion protocols.
Where now the culture is definitely having the players' welfare front and centre of their recommendations. But it's an incredibly vexing issue. The AFL and NRL are both, high speed, high impact sports. It's why people like to watch them.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's been a culture of shaking things off and, pressing forward. I mean, the fact, people getting taken out and suffering serious injuries was almost a badge of honour. It's a really difficult thing for both leagues that they're managing with. You know, it's seen been something that feels like the AFL's had to grapple with a lot more this year. The NRL has some pretty clear-cut concussion protocols, but obviously the AFL is grappling with these sort of aerial high-impact collisions, which I know we talked about yesterday. Toby Green's going to the tribunal tonight. Just overnight, we've had Damien Hardwick, the Gold Coast Suns coach, back Toby Green in as well, saying he wouldn't suspend him, but acknowledging under this new sort of anti-head knock regime, if I can put it like that, that he won't win this tribunal tonight. So it's going to be an issue that's just going to continue to dominate the headlines.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to know, you know, at what point it'll reach its head, because yes. So to speak, because you know, it's, at the end of the day, these are, as you say, high speed impact sports, and there's only so much you can do to remove that from these games.
Correct.
But we'll follow it very closely as it unfolds. Nightly sports editor Ben McClellan, thanks as always for joining us on the Nightly Five.
Thank you.
I went up to the Queen and I said, maybe like when you move on, maybe just give the crown to Beyonce.
That was Rebel Wilson making a joke about the Queen a while back, but the latest story about the Aussie comic and her tell-all memoir is not exactly a laughing matter. Wilson has claimed a member of the royal family invited her to a drug-fueled orgy at the home of a US tech billionaire. The Australian does not name the royal, but gives three hints. He's a male, it happened in 2014, and he was 15th or 20th in line to the British throne. In her memoir, Rebel Rising, she tells how she got a last-minute invite to a tech billionaire's party from the royal, who had told a male friend, "We need more girls at the party." According to the book, the medieval-themed party was held at a rented ranch just outside Los Angeles. Wilson says she wore a buxom damsel outfit complete with cone hat, which complemented her childbearing hips, that's her words, and describes the event as insane, with acrobats mingling with the crowd and a giant fire pit surrounded by cushions. She says she spoke to the billionaire, who also isn't named in the book, but he effectively blanked her on the night. At the party, she claims men were jousting on horses in a field and there was a swimming pool full of girls dressed as mermaids. Because of the vastness of the house and its isolated location, guests were assigned rooms to sleep in overnight. The star of Pitch Perfect and Bridesmaids describes seeing the minor British royal there and drugs openly being handed around on trays. She added that after a lavish fireworks display, another unnamed man appeared with a tray of what looked like sweets, but were actually the drug MDMA. When she asked what they were for, the man replies, "Oh, it's for the orgy. The orgies normally start at these things at about this time." According to the memoir, Rebel made a speedy exit from the party shortly afterwards, but her book has left us with another tantalising guessing game.
Very nice.
And that, folks, is today's show. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and join me tomorrow on The Nightly Five.
The Nightly Five podcast is brought to you by Seven West Media. For all these stories and more, head to thenightly.com.au, helping you get in front of tomorrow.